about our last session then. So maybe we should concentrate on having a good meditation. But there's plenty to say. But let's see. So this is dispelling objections. So there's somebody still worrying whether our view is correct or not. So there's somebody who's asking now, okay, you're correct as according to the momentary parts, but what about the continuum itself? So there's a paragraph that begins, if you think that this mode of being is correct from the point of view of the momentary parts, but not correct from the point of view of the continuum per se, because some functioning things which are continua, having been created, remain even till the end of psychic existence without disintegrating. So that's the doubt, you see. But as we've kept saying, you know, we're just repeating the point, driving it home. It is as we have conclusively explained. Since the moments disintegrate, so does the continuum. From the point of view of the continuum, something may be suitable to remain as long as space, for instance, the continuum of your mind. But it does not so remain without momentarily changing. So that's the outsider's doubt is, yeah, look, if it's changing, how can you say it's the same thing? How can you say the mountain is here in the morning and still here in the evening? It's a different mountain that's there in the evening, in your view. So how can you say that the mountain persists? So there's something to do with, you know, the, I don't know, imputed existence, you see, as opposed to substantial existence, isn't it? That's something to do with it. But also a simpler explanation, the continuation of similar type. It doesn't have to be exactly the same, but it looks the same. But we're bringing the observer into the picture, you see. They want the thing to be fixed from the side of the object, but we're having some kind of, you know, input from the observer. To the observer, it is, you know, similar enough to say, look, you know, the mountain is there in the morning and the mountain is there in the evening. But it's a different mountain. But we're still correct to say the mountain persists. But the mountain in the morning is not the mountain in the evening. The mountain in the evening is not the mountain in the morning. Is there something that's still there in the evening that was there in the morning? Yes, the mountain. See? So that works out. Then the mountain is there in the morning, the mountain is there in the evening. Yeah, so when I see, you know, I saw Steffi yesterday, so I see her again today, so I can say that's Steffi. That's not grasping at permanence. It still is Steffi. But the Steffi that's there in the morning, if you grasp that one to be the same one as you see in the evening, then that's grasping at permanence. That might lead to, you know, confusion. It's changed the mind, you know. People do. But you're not expecting that if you're grasping at permanence, you know. You're not prepared for that. So, you know, it's probably the best way of saying it, isn't it? To say that there's something underlying, something within Steffi that persists, like that's permanent, you know. So the essence of Steffi is permanent, isn't it? You know, like that. Can you say that? You know, it's I don't think it comes in. He talks about the mountain somewhere later on, but maybe not just here.
She can't be permanent because she's born and she's going to die.
Yeah.
So she can't be permanent at all.
That's right. But some people, the opponent wants to think that there is something. Because we say that Steffi's in the morning, Steffi in the evening, eh? So there's got to be something that's there without change. But no, that actually leads into a great number of problems, just as you say. If she's permanent then how can she change? So she'd stay just as she is, you know. She wouldn't get old or, you know, get wiser or, you know, whatever. So that's their problem. These people have grasped, they try to say the self is permanent, you know, all the way to enlightenment. But then how does somebody become wiser? How do they remove their afflictions, their permanence? Or how can they, you know, have any sort of fluctuation or change? And they say, well, on the outside is changing, but the inside is permanent or something, you know, but this, that leads just to, you know, total complication. So, and from the Lama's lips, I think here he's talking about his own personal Lama, I suppose. From the Lama's lips, I think it just means his own teacher. His own teacher used to say, household of Pelkhye, for instance, indeed remains for 100 years, but how could he remain without undergoing change? He could not. So, the 100-year-old man on his 100th birthday. So, household of Pelkhye. Today it's his 100th birthday, yes. So, he's 100 years old today. So, there's some debates here, I can't remember. So you say, considering the subject of the 100-year-old Pelkhye, was he born today? He was born today because he was produced today. He is produced today because he came into existence today and is a functioning thing. He arises out of causes. So is Pelkhye a functioning thing? Yes. And the 100-year, considering this is with the 100-year-old Pelkhye, mm-hmm. So he did arise out of cause and conditions, and he rose today.
Why?
Well, yesterday he was only 99, so yesterday the 100-year-old Pelkhye didn't exist.
Why?
Because he was only 99. The 100-year-old Pelkhye did not exist yesterday. Because he's only 100 years old today. So he was 100 years old yesterday then.
No, even though he's 100 years old today, doesn't necessarily mean to say that he was... No, that doesn't make sense.
Yes. So the 100-year-old Pelkhye came into existence today. So it feels first means that yesterday there was no 100-year-old Pelkhye. There was only 99-year-old Pelkhye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So considering the subject 100 years old Pelkhye follows... he is produced today. Because he's newly produced today. His 100th birthday is today. So yesterday he was only 99 years old, so it follows that 100-year-old Pelkhye was produced today.
100-year-old, not
Pelkhye. The 100-year-old Pelkhye was produced today.
But Pelkhye wasn't produced today.
Answer the question. Considering the subject, the 100-year-old Pelkhye follows his produced today. Except, so it follows he's born today.
Why?
No.
Because he was produced today.
No.
Born and produced, aren't they the same thing for a human being? That human being was produced, that human being is born, you know?
No, it was only the 100-year
age produced. Yeah, so it follows a 100-year-old man is not born. Follows a 100-year-old Pelkhye was not born. So 100-year-old Pelkhye was born.
Yes, but a long time ago.
So the 100-year-old Pelkhye was born. So the 100-year-old
yes.
Pelkhye was born.
Yeah.
It was born today, or was born 100 years ago?
100 years.
So it follows, considering the 100-year-old Pelkhye, it follows a bit that he's been 100 years old for 100 years. Because the 100-year-old Pelkhye was born 100 years ago. The 100-year-old Pelkhye, considering this of the 100-year-old Pelkhye, follows was born 100 years ago.
No.
No. Yes.
The 100-year-old Pelkhye was born 100 years ago.
Considering this of the 100-year-old Pelkhye, he follows was born yesterday. Sorry, he was born 100 years ago.
Yes.
Except.
No. Yeah,
he was born 100 years ago. I'm not getting much. Considering this of the 100-year-old Pelkhye, follows was born 100 years ago. So the 100-year-old Pelkhye, he follows, is now 200 years old. Consider this of the 100-year-old Pelkhye, he follows, now he is 200 years old, because when he was born he was 100 years old, and now another 100 years have passed.
Oh.
Hey!
The now 100 years. was born 100 years ago. Can you not say
look,
that?
There's four answers. There's I accept, why, reason not established, and no pervasion.
It's
a debating language. Yeah. Considering there's only 100-year-old Pelkey, like, he's a foreigner, okay, so a play on words he may not get, but you're English, and you're an English teacher.
I know.
So you should be able to... Considering there's only 100-year-old Pelkey, he follows he was born. Considering there's 100-year-old Pelkey, he follows he was born at a certain time. So considering the subject 100-year-old Pelkey, so when was he born?
100-year-old Pelkey.
Considering the subject, the 100-year-old Pelkey.
He was born yesterday. The 100-year-old
yesterday.
Pelkey. The 100-year-old
Pelkey. Considering the subject 100-year-old Pelkey.
100-year-old Pelkey was born.
So when he was born, he was 100 years old. Considering there's a 100-year-old Pelkey who was born yesterday, follows who was born yesterday.
Why?
I'll finish. Considering there's a 100-year-old Pelkey, follows who was not born yesterday. So considering there's a 100-year-old Pelkey, when was he born?
100 years ago.
So considering there's a 100-year-old Pelkey, he follows he's now 200 years old.
Why?
Because he was 100 years old when he was born, and 100 years have passed since he was born, so that's he's 200 years old.
He was not born as a 100-year-old Pelkey.
Yes, so we're not asking about young baby Pelkey, we're asking about the 100-year-old Pelkey. Considering the 100-year-old Pelkey,
so
he follows... when was he born then?
He wasn't born.
He wasn't born.
He was
from the 99-year-old Pelkey. So, there's a combination, there's a common locus of somebody who is a man and has not been born. Common base, something who's both on the one hand a man and has not been born.
No,
I don't know what sort of people you hang out with, but it sounds a bit suspicious.
He wasn't born as 100 years old.
Look, there's four answers. There's I accept, there's reason not established, no pervasion.
There's no pervasion in him being born and being 100 years old.
Can you not? I'm sorry, I don't understand the way that you work. I'm trying to understand, but my reasoning says that you can't say that sentence. But you could say the man who is now 100 years old was born 100 years ago.
Yes, there was a man who was not a woman born. That was Macduff, wasn't it?
By a woman. The sentence gets longer.
Macduff. What's yes, there's the wishes prophesied of Macbeth, you shall not be killed by any man that is of woman born or something.
It's Macduff.
Yeah,
Macbeth.
So that the wishes prophesied that to Macbeth. So Macbeth then thinks, oh, you know,
I'm fine,
you know, there's no guy going to make it to knock me off. But so then in the final battle with Macduff, Macduff says, Macbeth says, I've no need to fear you. I've no need to fear any man who is of woman born. But then Macduff says something like, I was from my mother untimely ripped, or something like that.
I was untimely ripped from my mother's womb.
Yeah, caesarean section in a very crude way or something. So then Macbeth says, the witches have been paltering with me in a double sense. So I think that is a debate where it's a paltering in a double sense, but how do you get out of it? He was born 100 years ago, but the 100-year-old Pelkey surely wasn't born yesterday, 100 years ago.
So how do you get out of it then?
Oh, well, if I knew the answer to that question, I'd be sitting up there with the Buddhas, completely enlightened.
But surely you can get out of it in the pavilion somewhere.
In what? What you have to do is stick to get take one answer and stick to it, you know.
Yeah.
And the debater will be, as soon as you take one sense, the debater will go into the other sense of what you've said, you know. And if you take that position, then they go to the other position. So that's just, yeah. But it's, have a few laughs on the debating ground, you know, in between all this meditation on impermanence. Yeah, so let's read a bit more and have a bit of a meditation. By means of this very explanation, thus, that the mode of being of subtle impermanence is that of disintegrating from merely having been produced, we can understand implicitly its opposite, the object that subtle permanent grasping fixates on. Above, there was the statement, for instance, that one should take the entity of momentary to be not remaining for a second establishment time, and, as applied to a whole or part possessor, such as a year, it's not remaining after the completion of its parts, 12 months. Do not, mistaken about this, suppose that the measure of subtle impermanence on a year is merely it's not remaining after 12 months are completed, nor that the mere opposite of that is the object adhered to by subtle permanent grasping. Otherwise it would follow the impermanence of a year would be a manifest phenomena, and other such incalculable damages would accrue to your position. So he's saying, like, you know, if you're going to refute permanence, it's not enough to refute some gross kind of permanence. Yeah? To refute permanence, you've got to refute a subtle level of permanence. So to realise impermanence, you've got to realise impermanence at the subtle level. So don't think, I know I'm going to die, or, you know, I can see this, tree is going to fall over as soon as the wind blows, because it's very rotten, you know, and it's swaying in the wind. You know, you can see that it's about to crash over and sort of die or whatever. You know, you can see something like that on the gross level, so you can say, oh, am I realising impermanence then? Well, in fact, not. You're just realising gross impermanence. You see, to get rid of your permanent grasping, you know, you've got to get rid of even the subtlest level of permanent grasping. Yeah. And so that means to say you've realised impermanence, you've got to realise a subtle level of impermanence, which is the antidote which removes even that subtle permanent grasping. So that's maybe that's one thing he's saying there. How do you know if I've just realised impermanence? If I hold this pot up on the second floor of the building and if I just drop it off, I know it's going to smash onto the pavement. So isn't that realising impermanent, you know? I know it's going to disintegrate in the next moment. But that's just a gross kind of impermanence. So to say somebody's realised impermanence, they have to realise that really subtle thing, you know, which is, keeps saying there, you know, disintegrating merely from having been produced, you know, and getting down to these really infinitesimal moments somehow, you know, that something it doesn't remain from what it is, you know, even in the very instant of production. It's just like passing away as soon as it's produced. So that's, other people have come up with other ideas and there's other explanations of what impermanence is, but he's saying now, that's the one you've really got to get at.
So yesterday you get to that realisation through meditation on impermanence or through meditation on kalpa and passion? Or is it the two?
Well, you've got to understand what's being taught, you know, so you have to... You have your hearing phase, and then, you know, the study phase, and then you have your contemplation phase. You make sense of that to sort of, do you agree with it or not? You know, is it actually true what you've heard? You know, so that's a kind of, you know, the phase when you examine the reasoning, and that's what you can say is the first stage of meditation. I don't know, or you can say that's contemplation, and meditation comes later. So that's what our debates are about in the sort of, you know, dialectic school. So then when you've got that sort of understood, then you go and meditate and really familiarise it, and maybe you wouldn't actually realise it until the state of strong meditation, because it is a bit of a hidden phenomena. So you first of all you'd have a reasoning consciousness which sort of proves it through a reasoning, we call it inference, you know. And then you meditate stronger and stronger on that, and then you eventually get this direct realization of impermanence. But that is that seems to be quite an advanced realization. So even people who, you know, go close to realizing emptiness, they still may not have realized subtle impermanence directly. Yeah, so it's I think you don't omit the meditation. Definitely not. It's not just some sort of intellectual thing. It's got to really be thought about and like brought to sort of make yourself kind of, you know, make that your feeling. That's the way things are. Yeah, so calm abiding, that kind of method of really making your mind concentrated, that enables you to meditate on such a conclusion very strongly, you see. So calm abiding would definitely be very helpful. And then compassion, of course, the more compassion meditation you do in the sort of the Buddhist way of looking at things, then the more that gives you some sort of energy of the mind to be able to meditate on these subtle things. You know, it gives you the right kind of merit or something, the right kind of, you know, mental energy that you can really, tackle these topics and keep your mind sort of focused on them instead of getting distracted or, you know, tired so quickly. So yeah, definitely meditation and compassion should help you, but as an assistant, not as the direct thing.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, certainly.
There's a sentence here that says the object adhered to by subtle permanent grasping. Why permanent?
Yeah, well, that's the
is that the mistake?
That's the ignorance. Yeah,
the ignorance.
Grasping at permanence. Yes, grasping at the object to be permanent,
see.
Grasping yourself to be permanent, or grasping at the object of your desire to be permanent. So that's it's not the mind is permanent, it's the thing you're grasping at is permanent.
I see.
So this should be really grasping of permanence.
Subtle grasping at permanence, or grasping at something which is permanent, yeah. That's how you're going to understand it, yeah.
Oh, right.
That's a bit ambiguous, is it?
Well, for people like me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I haven't got a technical background in the vocabulary and the way of putting things. Okay, now let's. It seems we've got a bit more time to go one stage further. And then won't get to the end, but we'll see how we get on. The third root outline, the explanation of the indicator-indicated relationship. Remember, the indicator, which means like the thing which proves impermanence, or the things which are impermanence, which, you know, the compounded things. You know, the first seed is compounded things are impermanent, but when you think about it in a reasoning way. How do you prove impermanence? You prove it through the reasoning of compounded things, you know. Pot is impermanent because it is a compounded thing, because it is a produced thing. So the indicator, that is the reason, or the sign, is then the compounded things, which we talked about first. Then the indicated is what is proved when you take that as a reason. We can use that to prove impermanence, so that's the indicated. And then the relationship between the two. So when we come to study the nature of a correct sign, a correct reasoning, then there's got to be some kind of relationship, you see. Relationship between what you're using as a reason and what you're trying to prove. You know, there's got to be some sort of, you know, connection between them. Otherwise, you can't guarantee you're proving anything. So, as we've been suggesting, the reason, if you put it in its simplest form, you could say something like sound, it is impermanent because it's produced. And, for instance, just like the last moment of the flame of a butter lamp. So in that three-part statement, if you leave out the similar example at the end, sound, it is impermanent because it's a product. So what's actually doing the work of the sign there then? What is the reason? Product, you see? So you've got a subject, sound. Then you've got the quality that you're trying to prove upon that subject. So that's the quality of impermanence. If you're going to realize impermanence, really you realize it on a subject. You know, the something is impermanent. So that's the way you'll think about it. So that's the predicate of something, you know. And then the third part, sound is impermanent because it's a product. Product is the sign. And of course, when you're examining that to see if that's true or not, first you could say to yourself, well, is sound a product then? You know, that's obviously got to be true. Sound is impermanent because it's a product. And if sound's not a product, then, you know, obviously reasoning will be quite cockeyed, isn't it? You know? See what I mean? So that's pretty one thing that's got to be true, that sound is a product. And then the other thing that's got to be true is that if it is a product, is it necessarily impermanent? You know, are all things that are products, are they impermanent, you see? Sound is impermanent because it's a product. So the other thing, which is in this case harder to prove, harder to think for you through, is, you know, if it is a product, is it necessarily impermanent? So that's the pervasion. Some people have brought this word pervasion in. So that would be the pervasion. The entailment, sometimes you say in fancier sort of logical language. So a lot more needs to be said there, really, but, you know, we haven't got time now to elaborate. But what we can say here maybe is, so there's got to be a relationship between product and impermanent. You see, there's got to be some guarantee that if it's a product, it's impermanent. So that's something that isn't necessarily, you know, going to be sort of understood just like immediately. You know, of course, common sense can think, and if it is a product, is it necessarily impermanent? Yeah, but you know, the person who's like bringing doubts to the table, you know, you can say, well, that's definitely how we phrase it. You know, if it is a product, is it necessarily impermanent? If it is a product, is it pervaded by being impermanent? So then, you know, people say, well, how are you going to establish that? Have you got to go through every product and check that they're all impermanent before you can say, if it's a product, it's necessarily impermanent? You know, and how easy is that? And if you do go through every product, did you go through this with Jeremy in his class?
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember.
So then if you do go through every product, is that, you know, is this table, is that impermanent? Yes. And is the microphone impermanent? Yes. Is the book impermanent? Yes. So then eventually you'll come to sound, and is sound impermanent? So yes. So how can you realize in that way of thinking, how can you realize if it's a product it's necessarily impermanent without realizing sound is impermanent? So you don't have to say all that fancy thing about sound is impermanent because it's a product. You just say, if it is impermanent, is it necessarily impermanent? And then you won't have to worry about sound taken separately, you know. So you'd be, when you're realizing the forward pervasion, then you'd be realizing, you know, the proof, the object to be proved. So did Jeremy bring that up?
Yes.
Yes.
So what was his answer then?
It's an example. He posits an example, simplifying example.
Aren't there certain criteria or something, rather than when you're looking at both establishing the reason, the sign on the subject, and also when you're establishing the forward pervasion? So exactly what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
Mm.
And do you have to sort of eat all the apples before you find the one that's not...
Yeah, so that's the problem, isn't it? You can say, if you say, to realise if it is a product, is it necessarily impermanent? To realise is yes. If you've got to go through every product, then that'll take the rest of your life, and you still won't be finished. Because there are so many of them, aren't there?
Mm.
But then if you say no... If it's a product, it's necessarily impermanent. You don't have to realize, you don't have to go through every product. then you have the thing like, you know, if it is a swan, it's necessarily white. So, is that true? If it is a swan, it's necessarily white?
No.
Have you seen a black one?
Yes.
Where? No, they're all white. No, they must be geese, they're not swans.
No, no, I saw them as a child.
As a child. Yeah, you probably saw a flying pig as well. They really have black swans in Australia.
And here, I've seen them here.
They must be genetically engineered, they're not real ones. Australia must be a funny place. Upside down, huh? Black swans. How are they common in Australia?
Yes, as common as white swans too.
Yeah, so you know, you could say, oh look, if it's a swan, it's necessarily white. Look, all the swans we see around here are white. So aren't we justified in saying, if it is a swan, it's necessarily white? We can't count them all, you know. But then somebody goes to London Zoo or, you know, Australia, and oh, there's a black one. So there's no pervasion. If it's a swan, it's necessarily white. No pervasion, considering the subject, the black swan in, you know, Melbourne or somewhere, Alice Springs. So how do you know that if it's a product, it's necessarily permanent? How do you figure that out?
You do supporting it.
Yeah, so that all you're doing there is saying the last moment of a butter lamp is impermanent and it's a product, yeah. So you've got the both of them there. Mm-hmm. You can say, yes, it is impermanent because it's a product, because, you know, if we've gone through a bit of that thinking. But are you then justified in assuming that everything that's produced from causes is also impermanent? How do you justify that?
Well, is that when you bring in
Well, you can think in those lines, yeah. You can say, definitely, and that's the counter-pervasion. So if it is permanent, it's necessarily... if it is product, it's necessarily impermanent. So that's the forward pervasion.
Mm-hmm.
But the counter-pervasion, which is equally true then, if it is permanent, it's necessarily not a product. So you've got the two classes. You've got the permanent class and the impermanent class. You can do a circle around them, you know. So where are you going to put product? So, but not just product itself, but, you know, anything which is a product, any product you come up with, like, you know, a piece of coal or, you know, the sun or something, you know, where are they going to go? So you've got to prove that the permanent class is empty. You know, there's no products in there. And then that's the same as proving that they're all in the impermanent class, right? Because we know that these products exist. We're not worried about rabbit horns and flying pigs, yeah? We know that if it's an existing thing, it's got to be either in the permanent class or the impermanent class. So all these products that are knocking about, where are we going to put them? So we say, well, yes, the last mode of butter lamp, now that goes in the impermanent class, because we can more or less see that, because it just goes from light to dark, yeah? But does that justify putting them all in the impermanent class? And then, yeah, one way is to think, yeah, now, if it is permanent, can it be produced? You know, if it's permanent, can it be a product? So you can say, you can work that way, look at permanent, and say, now, does permanent square with being produced? And so you can say, ah, no, the permanent class is that's empty of products. You know, there's no products in there. So then they must be all in the impermanent. So you can think about the counter-pervasion. Yes, it's very helpful to do that. Certainly. But how do you get to the point where you have this complete confidence that they're all in the impermanent class, all those infinite number of products?
Who's doing some awesome? I'm not sure if he was checking the reasons in a different way, still, like, going also to all this reasons, giving the other reason, more subtle reason, and then more subtle reason. But I don't remember whether it was between the subject and the reason, or subject and predicate.
Are we talking about the reason and the predicate here? Yeah.
No,
if it is a product, is it necessarily impermanent? Yeah.
You talked a lot about similar.
Yeah. So you can bring a bit of jargon in, but maybe we should avoid that. So what you find is they talk about relationship. There's an unerring relationship, a kind of, you know, an unfailing relationship between impermanent and product. So if something is in the nature of being produced, it will also be in the nature of being impermanent. So that's kind of a nature, a relationship of nature, they're the same nature. But you've studied a little bit like that. No, you haven't even reached that. You're still on cause and effect, your class, aren't you? So, yeah, you haven't reached that.
But he talked about nature or identity and relationship in causal.
So what's the other relationship? Yeah, well, we say effect relationship, yeah.
Yeah.
So we can at least look at that without, you know, pinning the whole thing down, and it's time to meditate, really. But this, just to say then, just read this one more paragraph, and then we can just have to suspend things there. So you've got this relationship of nature, you know. If it is in the nature of product, it must be in the nature of impermanent. That's what we've been trying to persuade ourselves so far. So then you do talk about the relationship of nature, natural relationship. And the other relationship is like between effect and cause, as we'll see. So the nature of production is creation, and the nature of impermanence is disintegration. So the former, indicating the latter, is that I missed a word out there. As that being created, it should read, indicates disintegrating. The manner of that, like smoke indicates fire, for instance, and effect indicates a cause, or like the tangible object hot indicates fire, for instance. An essence indicates a possessor of that essence. At least to the latter. Or as it says in Sutra, whatever things slightly possess the essence of being created, they all possess the quality of ceasing. Okay, so we stop there. So just to explain that a little bit, we can't really go into all the details, but you can have a sign which relies on the relationship between an effect and a cause. So that would be something like, the classic example is in Tibet, you know, you have these mountain passes, and you have to climb up the mountain pass and go down the other side. But if you see, you might see a column of smoke rising on the pass, and you are walking up this pass and you're very weary and cold, you know, but you think you see the smoke. So what do you know from the sign of the smoke?
There's fire.
You know, there's a fire there, so you think, oh yeah, we can go up there and light our cigarettes, or we can go up there and maybe we'll get a cup of tea or something, get warm, you know. So from the sign smoke, you can deduce fire. You can't see the fire because it's like behind the hill, but you can see the smoke rising. So, which is the effect? Which is the cause? Fire and smoke?
Fire
is the cause. Smoke's the effect. So it's from the effect that you can deduce the cause. Yeah? You're walking down the street, there's smoke coming out of somebody's chimney. So I think so, there must be a fire in they're having a fire in that house, you know. So I've done that before. You're walking home and you see the smoke coming out of the chimney, you think, oh good, there'll be a fire when I get home, I'll be able to get warm, you know. So you can be quite sure that from the smoke, that's a very reliable sign, incontrovertible sign of fire. So there's a relationship such that there's no smoke without fire. So we can realise that, you see. We're quite convinced about that. We're quite sure about that. It's an unerring relationship. The smoke won't come from anywhere else but from a fire. It may need some other causes as well, but there's got to be a fire. It won't come just from a fire. You know, that's in the proverbial language, isn't it? No smoke without fire, you know. Means something slightly different in the proverb, isn't it? You know. And so when there's gossip about you, it means you must have done something wrong or something like that, you know. kind of approach. But in the literal sense, it's kind of, you know, take that true. Like, so how do we know there's a relationship between smoke and fire? Well, we build it up from, you know, occasions when we can see smoke and fire together. So in the Tibetan classic case, that's in the kitchen, you know, the Tibetan cooking on yakdung and stuff, so the kitchen is often full of smoke. And in the monastery, they used to cook on these little big wooden fires, you know, and you know, lots of smoke pouring out, you know, sort of the real old-fashioned kitchen, you know, boiling up these big vats of tea. So the example is the smoky kitchen, you see. Considering the subject on the smoky pass, there is fire because there is smoke, just like the smoky kitchen. So the smoky kitchen is, you can see the smoke and the smile together. The fire is not a hidden phenomenon there. The fire is very manifest. So you can see the smoke pouring off the fire. So you know, yeah, well, that smoke is always, that's how it's produced. It's produced from fire. So you establish the relationship. But you don't have to go through every fire in the world, and you know, every bit of smoke in the world, to say, is that come from fire? Is that come from fire? At a certain point, you understand the relationship between smoke and fire. That there's no smoke without fire. So that's maybe slightly easier relationship, you know, between two things. One is the effect, one is the cause. But then product and impermanent, that's not a question of effect and cause. Those two things are the same nature. It's like, if it has the nature of production, of being, having been produced, you know, then it will also have the nature of being impermanent. So if it's produced from causes and conditions, it will also have the same, another quality it will have, invariably, is impermanence. Just like, you know, the last moment of the flame. So that's how you go on. You see, you look at the easy examples, but it doesn't like you have to go through every example in the world, but you, at a certain point you can say there's an invariable relationship. That's the relationship, you see. You establish a relationship. And you get to your proof that way. Yeah, it's not in the nature of a swan that it has to have white wings or white feathers. But it is in the nature of something to produce that it has to be impermanent. So then you have to meditate on that. Well, could you have something that is produced, like this steel, stainless steel cup of mine I used to have in India? So when it's being produced, the metal's being folded and it's being polished and the handle's being riveted on and so on. Okay, yeah, so then it's all very impermanent. But then it's put on the shelf in the warehouse, just in these sort of, you know, quiet conditions of the in the box, packed up in the warehouse, ready to be sent to the shops. So it doesn't, nobody's scratching it, nobody's hitting it, nobody's banging it against the kitchen sink. So doesn't it become permanent at that time? And then when somebody picks it out of the box and sells it and handles it and puts fingerprints on it and, you know, gets it hot with water, then it becomes impermanent again, you know. So there's a sort of eliminate that sort of possibility that it could be sort of permanent at some times, you know. So those are the questions that still need to be thought about, maybe. But let's have a last meditation, and then we'll chant the closing verses. Somebody got some more questions? I don't know. We should. It's time to meditate, really. So what are we going to meditate on? 100-year-old Pelkhi. Is he 100 years old or not? When was he born? So just breathing meditation first. Few rounds. Just to refresh ourselves. So let's just take refuge in our object of refuge, the brilliance of the wisdom of the Buddhas, the Dharma refuge. The Buddha is the teacher, the Dharma is the teachings. Those are the teachings in the sort of the verbal form, the explanations, and then in the realized form. So that's the actual wisdom in the minds of somebody, the Buddha, or somebody who's realized emptiness directly. So that's the actual antidote to all the suffering of the world, the root antidote. So that's our kind of true refuge. There is an antidote to all the suffering in the world, so that we can aspire to. So let the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, let's feel their influence, feel their encouragement, purifying away our hindrances, ripening up our good potentials. So let's feel that energy just available to us. And all sentient beings, or other creatures, they also, just like us, are seeking happiness and wish to avoid suffering, wish to be done with suffering forever. So they're just like me. They also have the Buddha nature. They also have the same potential to be completely free of suffering. How kind they've been to me on previous occasions. Just because I don't remember those occasions. So many past lives, so many opportunities for others to have been treated me with the best of attention, the best of kindness. So there's no sentient beings who is the kindness to be repaid there. Cherished people to be cherished, whatever their aspect now. At one time they've been they've treated us very dearly. So wishing then to become enlightened for the benefit of all. Make that our vast motivation. So let's just meditate for a few minutes then. On this reasoning to prove impermanence at the subtlest level, as far as we can understand it. So the reasoning is something like, sound, the subject, it is impermanent because it's a product. Just like the last moment of a butter lamp. So the first thing we can check is that, is sound a product? Is sound produced? Well, if we're thinking about the sound of a voice, you know, obviously it's produced from human effort. It's produced from our own effort. And, you know, in many cases, we can see something being produced. We can see the sprout being produced from the seed. We see the bud ripening up and flowering, turning into a blossom, a bloom. So we can see the eggs being beaten up, turning into an omelette. So, you know, these production is not such a hidden thing. Production is like the more obvious, more manifest characteristic from which we can, you know, go from that. That will lead us into understanding of the more hidden characteristic, impermanence. So we're reasoning from the more manifest to the more hidden phenomena. So we can see many different kinds of sound. All seem to be produced, don't they? Whether it's from effort, from the effort of different creatures, or from, you know, just naturally produced, the sound of water, the sound of wind. So we have to be clear about that. Then we want to say, if it is produced, then is it necessarily impermanent? So that's when we're going into more, you know, that's more sort of a difficult thing to be confident about. So this is where the similar example comes in. Of course, we have to say, is the last moment of the flame of the butter lamp, is that produced? Well, yes, of course, we have to understand that's produced from the fuel. So there's one last drop of fuel in the wick, from which you get the last moment of flame. And we can keep saying, then no more fuel, then no more flame. And that's kind of a, you know, that change from light to dark, that's very manifest. So if you wanted another moment of flame, then you'd have to have another moment of fuel. So if we look back along the continuum of flame into the past, you know, we can say, yes, every moment of flame that did occur, it came from a new moment of fuel. So then it's kind of more easy to see that the, you know, it's produced in every moment. It's not just produced at the beginning of its continuum and then it carries on until it gets, you know, interrupted by a blowing wind or somebody pouring water or fuel running out or something. It's not like it just carries on until it sort of meets an external cause. No, it's like every moment has to be produced. Every moment of that flame is like produced newly from a different, you know, drop of fuel. So it's produced in every moment. And as soon as it's produced, then it's going out. As soon as that fuel's, you know, done its, you know, chemical reaction, then the flame flares up and then just expires, isn't it? Just finished. So to produce a continuous flame, then you've got to have fuel, like, travelling up the wick. So it's very much a question of, you know, anything that's produced then is just going to do its thing and then disappear, become something else. In the case of the flame, it really does disappear, doesn't it? It becomes, you know, the flame is replaced by darkness unless there's another moment of fuel still left to burn. So everything there in that series is produced and then disappears. It's produced and transforms. It produces, passes away. And how long does it last before it passes away? From being produced till when it expires. Each molecule of fuel, how long does it produce a flame for? So if you think about that one, you know, you can really build up a strong confidence, can't you, that if it is produced, then doesn't it have to be impermanent? Aren't all effects like that? That they can only, you know, last for as long as it takes to perform their little thing, and then they just, it'll become something else. It'll arise in another way from another, you know. Another transformation. So just like the reflection of the moon on the rippling water. No stability there. So then you can transfer your attention, when you're ready, to the actual subject, which in this case is sound. And if you think about the sound of your own voice or the sound of a trumpet, just think how it's produced, you see. Just so that your breath is, you know, you pass the breath up through the windpipe, reaches these flaps in the voice production zone, you know, these two flaps of skin, I think, like it's like the two reeds of a clarinet or something. So the air being passed through them makes them vibrate. And then so that point the air becomes you know, it starts to, from that point, the air proceeds in waves. Like there's pressure in the air, so but it's not sort of a constant pressure, it's like a strong pressure, then weak, strong, weak, strong, weak, like just like the wave that ripples out from the middle of a pond when you throw a stone in the middle. There's sort of pressure moving through the water. You know, you get a peak and a trough, a peak and a trough, so that just moves out through the water. So then the air that's coming out of the mouth is just moving in that, in some sort of wave-like formation or something, which eventually will strike your eardrum and make your eardrum vibrate. So the first moment of sound does not produce a second moment of sound. If you want a second moment of sound, you need a second expulsion of breath. And you want a third moment of sound, then you have to keep breathing. You're breathing out with more breath. And a fourth moment of sound, again, you know, some more breath has to come out of the lungs. So again, you can, you know, one moment of sound doesn't produce another, so there's no continuum of similar type there. Not quite as obvious as the butter lamp, but each moment of sound needs a new moment of breath. So you know you've got very much a sort of a lead into impermanence. Each moment of sound is arising newly from a new moment of breath. So. What more does impermanence mean? So the sound is being produced continually from a new substantial cause. So obviously the sound's going to be new in each moment. Obviously the sound is going to be like in a process of continual change, a flow of change. So eventually we'd hope to get to the point where we can completely confident then that nothing could be produced and then become just static and then become permanent. Well, nothing could be produced having the nature of being permanent, unchanging. Nothing whatsoever. That'd be like two just completely opposite characteristics which could never exist on the same basis to be produced from causes and be permanent. We see that those two are completely like, you know, one excludes the other. So all the anything that's a product would then, you know, you kind of know it's going to be, have to be in the impermanent class. Whatever it is, even if it's a product you never even thought of and never even been invented yet, if it's produced from causes and conditions, it's still going to be in the impermanent class, for sure. Merely through being produced, it's impermanent. Doesn't need, you know, somebody else to come along and and push it, or hit it with a stick, or blow it, or induce it to change. It's just changing, like, just by its very nature. Just going on and on, cause producing effect, cause producing effect. And so we also are like that. Finally, we have to transfer our attention to ourselves and just briefly see if we ourselves are just continually transiting, or continually ephemeral. Continually fading, you know, like the cherry tree blossom. The triple world's impermanence, like autumn clouds, the birth and death of beings, like looking at a show, the passage of a life, like lightning in the sky, so swiftly rushing, like a mountain waterfall. So let's dedicate our merits now. We'll stop there. So all the good efforts we've made at this weekend, let's dedicate them to following the path. So we'll just have our recitation of the stages of the path now. Also dedicate them to all other beings finding the way to sure happiness. Dedicate the merits of the long life, the pure teachers. The long continuation of Jamyang Dharma Center. Any near and dear ones we have who are suffering, you know, gross impermanence of horrible kind. And then to something good for Tibet, where our teachings have been preserved for so long, with such degree of realization. So shall we recite those verses then? Before the Shakya Lord I bow my head, your form from hosts of perfect virtues born, your speech fulfills the hopes of boundless beings, your mind sees as they are all knowables. Maitreya and Manju Ghosh I bow to you, our pillars, teachers, foremost spiritual sons, the task of all our conqueror's deeds assumed. You emanate in play to countless realms. At Nagarjuna Sangha's feet I bow, earth's ornaments renowned through our three worlds. You show just as it is the intention of the mother of the conqueror's heart to sound. Atisha, homage, treasure, who holds the full and flawless fifth instructions for the path of the profound view and vast deeds, passed down well by the two great charioteers. I bow to you, my teachers, with respect. I sing all endless scriptures moved by love. With skillful deeds you show the fortunate, the best approach which leads to liberty. Of all earth's learned ones, crown ornaments, their fame a banner shining forth all beings. From Nagarjuna Sangha down in line, this greater part of Buddhahood has passed. It yields all creatures' wishes without fail, a prized instruction like a powerful king, collecting myriad streams of splendid texts, an ocean too of glorious eloquence. Know all his speeches contradiction-free, all scriptures see as personal advice. The intention of the conqueror find with ease. Say from the chasm of the great mistake, so who will sense will not be captured by the three beings' great and past supreme advice. Adhere to by the many fortunate, the learned bonds of Vindhya and Tibet, for certain to explain or hear but once this essence brief of scriptures all accrues, vast benefit of teaching, listening to true Dharma, contemplate its meaning then. Correct and strong reliance in thought and deed upon a spiritual guide who shows the path, know is the root cause well propitious for all excellence of this and future lives. The life may be the cost, delight him with the offering of doing what he says. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Far finer than a wish-fulfilling gem, this life with leisure found, but now this wants. So hard to find, soon lost, a lightning flash. Reflecting in this fashion, realize well, all worldly deeds are but as winnow chaff. So always seeds its essence day and night. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Not sure death brings no birth in evil realms. Convinced the triple gem relieves that fear. Take steadfast refuge, precepts untransgressed. And also it depends on this thing well, on actions black and white and their effects. Then do or cast aside as should be done. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Form well in thou to win the highest path, till thou is found there's no progressing far. Train in its causes nothing incomplete, its vital creedle soiled with wrongdoing stains. Be cleansed not least of karmic hindrances, be always keen to use the fourfold paths. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Unless you try to know true suffering's faults, no genuine urge for freedom grows thing too. On origin, samsara's causal stage, if not, you won't know how to cut its root. So then despair of and renounce the world, all keen to know what binds you to the round. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Awakening mind, a great wave center post, support and base for mighty waves of deeds, elixir making both collections gold, a merit hoard of countless virtues massed. The hero conquered children, knowing this, make that most precious mind their inmost bond. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. The wishing jewel of giving grasping's hopes, fine blade that cuts the knot of meanness through, conquerors children's deed is source and base of dauntless courage, far resounding fame. The wise ones, knowing this, the good partake of giving body, wealth, and virtues all. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Its waters cleanse away misconduct stains, its moon rays soothe affliction's fever pangs. Superb like mirror amidst a myriad beings, who all bow down to that no power can daunt. Morality, the noble, knowing this, adopt it well and guard it like their eyes. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. For there is best adornment of the strong, the perfect means to bear affliction's sting. Garuda to the snake of hate opposed, strong arm against the weapon of harsh words. So knowing this be trained in always in the armor of forbearance unsurpassed, I too a yogi practiced in this way. You too who yearn for freedom do the same. Attired with steady ceaseless diligence, your insights and your scriptural knowledge grow. Wax like the moon, your acts all purposeful. Whatever work succeeds as you intend, the conqueror children knowing this cut off laziness with forceful diligence. I too a yogi practiced in this way. You too who yearn for freedom do the same. Then concentration sovereign o'er the mind, when placed like Meru never wavering, send forth it takes of virtuous objects all, to body and mind great bliss of plants he brings. Great yogis knowing this resort to it, to quell the foe distraction at all times. I too a yogi practiced in this way, you too who yearn for freedom do the same. And wisdom I sing suchness most profound, part to extract samsara's very root, the source of excellence in scripture praise, most faint of lamps to lift confusion's gloom. The wise yearn for freedom knowing this, with every effort generate that path. I too a yogi practiced in this way, you too who yearn for freedom do the same. One pointed concentration by itself, we don't see how can cut samsara's root, nor wisdom lacking karma abiding's path dispel the afflictions much though it may probe. So mount the wisdom settling how things are, upon unwavering calm abiding steed. Wide wisdom then probe well with its sharp sword, of reason's middle way beyond extremes. Destroy all objects of extremist views, and so make insight into suchness vast. I too a yogi practiced in this way, you too who yearn for freedom do the same. With concentration from what need to say, one-pointed focus plus discernment that precisely proves a concentration rose that's fixed unwavering on the mode of being. Amazing who seeing this strive to achieve united calm abiding and insight. I too a yogi practiced in this way, you too who yearn for freedom do the same. Praise those who jewel voidness cultivate, in equipoise the space like voidness and post meditation the illusion like, by wisdom joined with method then perfect, the conqueror children's deeds the fortunate, sing this to rest content with partial paths. I too a yogi practiced in this way, you too who yearn for freedom do the same. Supreme great fickle paths cause and effect, both need the common path that practiced well. Save guidance from an expert pilot take, and send a tempest sets vast ocean o'er. Heed all that pith advice may meaningful, the leisure and endowments you've obtained. I too a yogi practiced in this way, you too who yearn for freedom do the same. In order to acquaint my mind with it, and serve those others with good fortune too, I have explained in plain and simple words the hope of pleasing to the conquerors. Pray all my greatest by this virtue be, not parted from the excellent pure path. I too, a yogi, made prayers in this way. You too, yearn for freedom, make the same. Well, that's it. Only thing left now is Reiki. Is that what they're doing, Reiki? Reiki 1, is it? But they're beaming it out now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Offerings and.
Thank you.
Want, yeah. Us, well, we don't have to invite you because it's coming. So.
Have to invite you again more then, yeah.
Yeah, we're inviting more. It's another show again and again and again.
Yeah. Well, I'll see you in a month or so. Well, that's a course on suffering, so that's not going to be easy, is it? Why didn't we call it a course on happiness? Why didn't Buddha teach the truth of happiness?
We like suffering.
Well, I hope you're ready for it, because we could get pretty depressed. Despair of and renounce the world.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.